Hello again, everyone, wherever you may be, and welcome to KHOI Community Radio's Capital Week, your window on the world of Iowa politics, where we explore and analyze who's been making news in and around the state capital, what that news is, and what it all means. I'm Dennis Hart, joined as always by my partner in politics, Laura Bellin, of the blog site Bleeding Heartland. Welcome again, Laura.
Good to be with you, Dennis.
Laura, as it has often had, much of last week's political news revolved around those Republican presidential candidates who just keep pouring into Iowa ahead of next year's caucuses, pouring in. There were new polls from the New York Times, one taken here in Iowa, about the presidential race. We're going to talk about all that. But first, as has often been the case this year, one man dominated all the news politically. And of course, it was former President Donald Trump. A grand jury issued another indictment against Trump, this one in connection with the January 6, 2021 Capitol riot. Let's talk about it, Laura.
Yeah, so there were four charges. They were all related to attempts to subvert the peaceful transfer of power following the 2020 election. And again, as we've said before, Donald Trump is presumed innocent like any criminal defendant, but the indictment ran for more than 40 pages, and they had really amassed quite a lot of evidence about the former president and six co-conspirators who have not been indicted yet, but it's expected that most, if not all of them, will also be facing criminal charges at some point.
Trump was charged with, among other things, conspiracy to defraud the U.S., conspiracy to obstruct an official proceeding, attempting to obstruct an official proceeding, and conspiracy against people's civil rights to have their vote count. In other words, it alleges that Trump sought to discount legitimate votes and subvert the 2020 presidential election.
Yes, it's mostly related to his attempts to try to get the Electoral College count stopped on January 6th and also to try to get several states to change to send slates of pro-Trump electors, even though Joe Biden carried those states. And I want to be clear, because the former president and some of his supporters have said that this indictment is an attempt to criminalize speech. These are not really speech-related crimes. These are conspiracy and fraud-related crimes. And in fact, the indictment even says that it's not a crime to say that you won the election, to falsely claim that you won the election, but what was a crime was conspiring to obstruct the electoral vote count so that the rightful winner of the presidential election would not be seated. And an analogy I heard from a legal commentator last week was, if you think that that you have $5,000 in the bank and the bank says you have zero, you have every right to stand out there and say, they cheated me, they stole my $5,000. But what you don't have a right to do is walk in and rob the bank and demand that they give you $5,000.
As you indicated, no one else was charged alongside Trump, but the indictment describes six unnamed co-conspirators. And at the top of the list, pretty easy to figure this out, Rudy Giuliani, the former mayor of New York and a former lawyer for Trump.
Yes. And John Eastman, who wrote the famous memo that talked about ways that they could subvert the Electoral College count on January 6th, he's also one of the co-conspirators. Jeffrey Clark, who has an Iowa connection, a former senior person in the Justice Department who had hoped to be the acting attorney general, or in fact, maybe for a few hours even was the acting attorney general. He's also one of the unindicted co-conspirators at this point, but looks like they will probably be facing criminal charges later.
The Republican reaction from other presidential candidates, we've heard most of it before, not quite all of it. Ron DeSantis railed against, as he has before, the weaponization of the federal government. But he did later say that the claims Trump and his allies pushed about a stolen election were false.
And that was a little bit new, because Ron DeSantis in the past has tried to avoid answering the question of, did Donald Trump really win the 2020 election and was it stolen from him? So he seems to be coming down on the side of, no, the election was not stolen. But generally speaking, I would say that his rhetoric was Trump-like, talking about the weaponization of the federal government and portraying the prosecution as illegitimate.
A couple of other notable comments, this one from Mike Pence. He said the indictment serves as an important reminder: anyone who puts itself over the Constitution should never be president of the United States. He more and more is being forced to push himself away from Trump and say, hey, you know, he wanted me to do something I could not do.
Yes. And I saw that just recently that Mike Pence was walking into an event in New Hampshire and he was getting heckled by Trump supporters outside and being called a traitor. And he repeated that line that he will always choose the Constitution over any individual, and that somebody who tries to put any individual above the Constitution should not be president.
And the only other presidential candidates who spoke out and really ripped Trump, Will Hurd, who said Trump's presidential bid is driven by an attempt to stay out of prison, and Chris Christie, who's the attack dog. He says the events around the White House from election night forward are a stain on our country's history.
And I saw there was a recent Republican poll. This was a national poll, not an Iowa one, but that showed that Chris Christie had the highest unfavorable ratings in the entire Republican field. He's been on TV a lot in recent months, criticizing Donald Trump in very harsh terms. And that is not lost on the rank and file Republicans. Definitely seem to have taken Donald Trump's side.
Perhaps the most notable reaction from an Iowa persona came from Joni Ernst, of course, U.S. Senator. She dismissed the new indictments as, I'm going to quote, a nothing burger without any meat behind it. That is a remarkable statement.
I was a little surprised. I went back and looked at what Senator Ernst said during the second impeachment of Donald Trump. Remember, this was the impeachment that occurred after he had already left the White House. And she didn't say at that time, she didn't say that she was voting to acquit because it was a nothing burger or that nothing important happened. She said that she didn't think that Congress could impeach somebody who was no longer in office, and that, in fact, she even said that Trump should be responsible for what happened that day, but that since he was a former president and a private citizen, he shouldn't be impeached. So I thought that that was quite a striking statement. She was on Fox News in an interview when she said it was a nothing burger without any meat behind it, because that's definitely not what she said in the immediate aftermath of January 6th.
There were other reactions, but we've heard them before, much of them ripping the Justice Department for politicizing the prosecution against Trump. Bottom line for the presidential campaign, this is going to be, Laura, one the likes of which we have never, ever seen in this country.
Yes. And I do want to say that one thing that I thought was noticeable last week was that Governor Kim Reynolds did not issue any statement. She has very quickly been out with statements after the two previous indictments of Donald Trump, criticizing the Justice Department and dismissing the allegations. And she basically didn't say anything about this one. So I thought that was a bit surprising. But yes, this is this campaign. I mean, it really seems like it's going to be difficult for any of the other candidates to get any oxygen, because the whatever is going on with the various criminal cases, and there may be other indictments coming down the road, that is going to be dominating so many news cycles.
It's going to be a campaign interspersed with court appearances by Trump. Who knows what's going to be happening with the Biden campaign as Republicans come after Hunter Biden and maybe the president himself. This is going to be as vicious as we've ever seen.
Yes, certainly, especially since the two leading candidates, Joe Biden and Donald Trump, are both unpopular. They have their favorable ratings are well under 50%. And so that is generally a recipe for both sides trying to win an election by being more negative about the other side.
And let's talk briefly about a couple of New York Times polls that came out since our last show. One of them, a national poll, showed Biden and Trump each with 43% of the vote. That's as close as it can get. And then the other one was in Iowa, taken by the New York Times, showing 44% of likely caucus goers here would plan to vote for Trump, GOP caucus goers, 20% for Governor Ron DeSantis. That's closer than we've seen before, but it's still 24 points.
Yeah, I mean, it was kind of ironic because that is almost the best poll DeSantis has seen for a while, and he still has less than half of Donald Trump's support. But I mean, that was one of the polls, the Iowa poll, that at least showed Donald Trump below 50%. Most of the national polls of Republicans have shown Trump above 50% in a crowded field. And I will say that Iowa Republicans have been inundated with mailings. They've received a lot of mailings, not only from the other candidates, several of the Republican candidates have been sending a lot of direct mail, but some outside groups, including ones affiliated with the Club for Growth, Americans for Prosperity, they have been sending anti-Trump mailings that say, Donald Trump, it's going to be disaster if he's the nominee. We're going to lose everything. He's going to lose to Joe Biden. And as that New York Times poll showed, it's far from clear that he would lose to Joe Biden. I mean, I think you could make an argument that Biden would be slightly favored. But in any case, Iowa Republicans have received a lot of messages about Donald Trump being unelectable. And maybe that has affected his standing. And that's why he's only at 44% here, rather than above 50%. But he is still well ahead of the rest of the field. He never had a lead this large going into the 2016 caucuses.
Let's talk about the Republican presidential candidates who showed up yesterday. That's right, Monday. No, Sunday. This is Monday as we go live in Cedar Rapids. And this was for Ashley Hinson's annual barbecue bash at Hawkeye Downs Speedway and Expo Center. Seven candidates were there. None of them broke new ground.
It was very similar to all of the speeches they had given at the Iowa GOP's recent Lincoln Dinner fundraiser. So I listened to all the speeches. The Cedar Rapids Gazette did take the videos and post them online if anybody wants to watch those. I was waiting to hear something different. It was very subtle electability arguments from Ron DeSantis and Nikki Haley. A very rousing speech by Vivek Ramaswamy, and fairly subdued from Asa Hutchinson and Doug Burgum. Doug Burgum really tried not to talk about Donald Trump. He tried to talk about the economy, energy, and security. But I just think it's going to be really difficult for any of these candidates to make the election about something other than Donald Trump.
So if you think that you've heard enough, seen enough of the Republican candidates, well, we're just getting started because the Iowa State Fair opens up this Thursday, and virtually all of them are going to be there, except, of course, Donald Trump, not just in one location, but in two locations.
Yes, most of them are going to be doing two appearances at the fair. Of course, it's a long tradition for presidential candidates of both parties to come to the fair to mingle with people and usually to speak on the Des Moines Register's political soapbox. This year, only 10 of the Republican candidates are going to speak at the Des Moines Register's soapbox, but 12 of them have agreed to sit down for one-on-one interviews or mock interviews, maybe with Governor Reynolds. She usually goes to the fair every day throughout the fair. And so I'm going to be very curious to hear the tone of her questioning and whether she asks them any tough questions or whether it's mostly inviting them to give portions of their stump speeches.
So we can't give you the exact days and times of every candidate because it's too difficult on radio to visualize this. We'll just say this: coming up on Thursday, this Thursday, August 10th, the governor is going to talk to Larry Elder, the talk show host, and at the Register soapbox, same day, August 10th, Doug Burgum, Mike Pence.
Yes, and the Des Moines Register's website does have a political soapbox schedule like they do every year. Also, the governor's website, she has posted on her social media what her schedule is going to be with the interviews for anybody who wants to go and see this in person. I'm sure all the videos will all be available online afterwards later.
And one of the more interesting things that came out last week is a piece by the Des Moines Register, which reported that Robert F. Kennedy Jr., who is running as a Democrat against Joe Biden, is going to mount a campaign in Iowa to challenge him. He's planning to spend money for ads on TV, the internet, and in the mail. He's hiring campaign staff. He's going to be at the Register soapbox. Robert F. Kennedy Jr., to many people, is a crank because he is anti-vaccine and a conspiracy theorist. How much of a campaign do you think he can mount in terms of challenging Biden?
Well, he's raised a lot of money, and actually I've been looking into some of the coverage of his fundraising, and a lot of his major donors are people who normally give to Republican candidates. And there are also a couple of super PACs that plan to be supporting him that have gotten multi-million dollar donations from people who typically give to Republican candidates. So Iowa is a fairly cheap state to campaign in, and I think with that kind of money, we probably will see a fair number of ads for RFK Jr. The problem that he has is that what I've seen of the polling is that he's more popular among Republicans than Democrats right now. So I just don't know. The Democratic caucuses in a year like this, when we have an incumbent president, it's not likely to be high turnout. And so I would be fairly surprised if he's able to get a lot of people coming. A lot of his big fans are going to be attending the Republican caucuses, which, of course, will happen the same night.
Laura and I were talking before this broadcast tonight that we have not had a quiet week all year on Capitol Week. Well, next Monday is not going to be quiet either, because we're going to be talking about a whole lot of these candidates who will already have appeared at the state fair. I'm already getting excited about it, Laura.
I am. Well, I'm curious to see if they say anything different. I mean, I imagine their soapbox speeches will be very similar to the standard stump speech. And that's why I'm wondering, I don't know what the format is the governor plans to use for these one-on-one interviews, but I'm very curious to hear whether they get into any territory that these candidates haven't discussed. I think we forgot to mention that Donald Trump has not agreed to sit down with Governor Reynolds. He's the only one in the Republican field who hasn't. And as for the Des Moines Register soapbox, Donald Trump, Ron DeSantis, and Tim Scott have all said no to that one.
And nor has Donald Trump agreed to appear in the Republican Party's first televised debate later this month.
That's right. And so we don't know how many candidates. It looks like at least a half a dozen candidates have qualified it. But the big question, I would guess, based on some of his other public statements, that Donald Trump probably is going to skip that debate.
All right, it's 15 after the hour. Wherever in the world you are listening to us, and what is it you're listening to? This is KHY Radio's Capital Week with Laura Bell and And me, Dennis Hart. Actually, it's I, Dennis Hart, but I like to be informal. We are your one-stop source for everything political going on in Iowa. We're here every week at this time to talk about what's been happening in and around the state capitol and what it all means. So now me, Dennis Hart. No, it's I, Dennis Hart. Well, I want to talk about Governor Reynolds sending Iowa Guard troops to the southern border. This is very interesting for so many reasons, and you brought up a big one in your blog, but let's talk about the basics first. She's going to send 109 soldiers from the National Guard to Texas in support of Operation Lone Star. What's the problem with all this, Laura?
So people may remember a couple of years ago in July of 2021, the governor sent a couple of dozen state troopers down to Texas for about 2 weeks. It cost the state about $300,000. They were on a mission to help assist Texas law enforcement at the southern border. This is a pretty big increase from that. So 109 National Guard, Iowa National Guard troops are going down there. This is going to be the first time, I believe, that Iowa National Guard have been sent on this kind of mission. Other state governors have sent their own National Guard down there. But they're going to be there also, not just for 2 weeks, but for the entire month of August. And then for basically the entire month of September, a group of, it's not clear exactly how many, but probably at least two dozen state troopers are going to be going down, and they'll spend all of September. So this is going to be a much larger deployment in terms of the number of people and also the length of time they will be in Texas.
The governor says the cost for all this is going to be covered by American Rescue Plan money from the federal government, but you are saying not so fast.
Yeah, not so fast. I'm a little bit skeptical about that. So they, as I mentioned, the deployment 2 years ago was cost about $300,000 covered by the state. This is going to be substantially more expensive. And the governor's office said last week that, look, that the American Rescue Plan, that is the what congressional Democrats approved in early 2021. It was the last major COVID-19 relief bill, that this gives states a lot of flexibility to provide government services. And it is true that the American Rescue Plan is a lot more flexible for the states than the previous, the CARES Act, for instance, that was very targeted toward COVID relief. But the American Rescue Plan still does have limits. It's still supposed to be somewhat related to either making up for services that would otherwise be cut because of a budget shortfall, or it's supposed to have some connection to the pandemic. And I think it's going to be very difficult for them to show that this kind of mission applies. The governor's staff have said things like, well, fentanyl overdoses and fentanyl seizures have increased since the pandemic. That's not what it, I mean, the regulations that the Treasury Department put on this American Rescue Plan, it really has to have more of a connection to the pandemic than that. It has to be related to replacing government services because of budget shortfalls that happened because of the pandemic, not just something that happened during the same period of time as the pandemic.
So what might happen if she applies the money and then the government determines you can't apply the money?
Well, it's going to take a while for this process. I mean, the state auditor's office and possibly the U.S. Treasury's Office of Inspector General may be looking at this later. If it's determined that this is not an allowable use, what would happen is Iowa would have to give the money back, similar to in 2020 when the governor attempted to use $21 million from the CARES Act to buy that Workday computer system contract. And that ended up having to be returned to the Coronavirus Relief Fund. And then the state legislature ended up having to do a special allocation to pay for that. So it's possible that the state budget may end up paying for this deployment anyway, but in any case, that will take a long time to sort out.
All right, a story that broke this afternoon. Iowa Attorney General Brenna Byrd said she's suing the Environmental Protection Agency, the Federal Environmental Protection Agency, as Iowa and Nebraska try to force the EPA to issue final rules allowing the year-round sale of gasoline blended with 15% ethanol. That 15% ethanol thing is a big deal for Iowa.
It is. I mean, a lot of gas stations don't sell it, but there are more, increasingly, there are more gas stations that will sell E15 in addition to E10 is much more widely available across the country. This dates back to March of 2022 when a group of eight governors asked the EPA to issue this rule. And I'm trying to find some legal experts who really know more about the Clean Air Act than I do on this one. What I thought was curious was that eight governors originally asked the Biden administration to approve this year-round sale of E15, but only Iowa and Nebraska have signed on to this lawsuit. And so there has to be some reason. I'm just wondering why, for instance, the states of Kansas, North Dakota, South Dakota that signed on to that original request didn't want to sign on to this lawsuit. So I'm just wondering what it is. But in any case, they are claiming that the Clean Air Act requires the EPA to issue rulemaking once it's been requested by governors, and that hasn't happened. So they're hoping to get a court order to force the EPA to promulgate these rules.
Brenna Byrd campaigned on saying she would give them the bird if she was elected. She is certainly trying to do that almost on a weekly basis to the Biden administration.
Yes, and she asked, and also her office received, an increased budget appropriation to pay for more attorneys, and that she has a whole division that is basically working on suing the Biden administration. And one main area that they're working on is things related to agriculture and biofuels. So this is right up her alley.
Here's another story we have been following from the get-go. And this is about private school scholarships being paid for by public money. Des Moines Register reports on this Monday afternoon that more than 18,000 Iowa students have been approved to receive public money. I'm going to let you take the rest of it, but let's just say before that, that the state had estimated that about 14,000 students would apply in the program's first year. Already 18,627 have been approved.
Yes, and there may be more approved because there are still, I think, about 1,000 applications that they're still processing. But the bottom line is at more than 29,000 people applied to use state money to for private school tuition. One thing we don't know is how many of these students will actually be able to use the education savings account money, because they have to first get a place in a private school. We know from previous information released by the governor's office that an estimated 14,000 of them already attend private school, so certainly they would have a place at private school. But it's also possible that some of these students, their families applied for the program, but there may not be a private school in their area that admits their student. But in any case, if all 18,627 students were accepted to private school, this would end up costing the state more than $30 million on top of what was already appropriated for this program in the first year.
Right. The state had estimated about $107 million for this program. If it is $30 million more, here's a question. Where's that money coming from?
Yes, well, it would probably come from the state's general fund or some. I mean, the state is running a surplus. So what I'm trying to find out is whether the legislature would have to pass a supplemental appropriations bill next year to include that money, or whether there would be some way for the governor to just apply money from one of the state's reserve accounts to cover that cost.
All right. Here's something from the world of education. And it started in Urbandale last week, where the district said it's possible that as many as 374 books might be banned from the school and from libraries because of new state laws restricting books on sex and LGBTQ, all kinds of new laws. The district later said it would remove 64 of them. Okay, that's the start. Later, the State Department of Education said it does not plan to release detailed guidance on how to implement these new laws. Wow.
So this is the main law that we're talking about here is what it's Senate File 496. We talked about it a lot in the spring because it went through several different versions. But the final version said only age-appropriate materials can be in classrooms and school libraries. And age-appropriate does not include anything that has a visual depiction or a description of a sex act. And so that's pretty broad, right? It doesn't say graphic, explicit, pornography. It says any visual depiction or description of a sex act. And so that includes a lot of books of literature. And compounding the issue for people is that for some school districts, they share a public library shares with a small school district. And so now the public library, which is used by anybody in the community, is possibly having to either separate from the school or remove books. So a lot of school districts were hoping that the State Department of Education would have detailed guidance on what this means. That same law also says there can't be any instruction on sexual orientation or gender identity in grades K through six. Well, there are a lot of questions. Does that mean that all books that mention any LGBTQ people need to be removed from the library? What about, for instance, a biography of the Transportation Secretary Pete Buttigieg, which doesn't describe any sex acts, but does make clear that he's married to a man? And so a lot of educators were hoping that the State Department would adopt some kind of administrative rules that would really spell out what kinds of books need to be removed and which ones don't. And it looks like that's not going to happen.
Another story last week, the Jefferson County attorney decided not to pursue criminal charges against Republican State Senator Adrian Dickey after his daughter alleged he had forged her signature on a car lien application and related documents And he had already been in the news because he'd been arrested during the RAGBRAI right across Iowa. So this was an interesting turn of events.
Yes. So the lawsuit was actually filed right after the 4th of July. I didn't learn about it until after I had written about Senator Dickey's arrest during RAGBRAI. That was on that misdemeanor charge of interference with official acts. So I was able to confirm last week that he bought a car for his daughter in 2020. And after the car was totaled, she learned that there was a lien taken out on the car. And she is alleging that her father forged her signature on that, on the lien application and related documents. The Jefferson County attorney said that he looked at this, that the Iowa Department of Transportation looked at this, and they decided that they weren't going to pursue any criminal charges. When I read the lawsuit, the first question I had was, is it possible that he could be charged with forgery or fraud, insurance fraud of something like that nature? But it looks like that's not going to happen. The hearing on the motion to dismiss his daughter's lawsuit is going to happen later in August, and I will be following that closely.
4 minutes left, two topics. First, North Dakota denied Summit Carbon Cap. I hate my typing, by the way, on this format tonight. Wow, where's my spell check? Woof! Summit Carbon Solutions lost its bid Friday to build a carbon capture pipeline 320 miles across North Dakota. Well, that's one part of it. Now, opponents of that carbon capture pipeline in Iowa say, whoa, the State Utilities Board should not start hearing Summit's proposal to build 700 miles of the pipeline across Iowa.
This is a big deal because this Summit pipeline, it's supposed to go all the way across Iowa. It affects five states, but quite a large segment of it would be running across Iowa, connecting to several ethanol plants. And the whole point of it is to take this carbon dioxide underground to sites in North Dakota where it can be sequestered. Well, if North Dakota has not given the permit, has in fact denied the permit to construct this pipeline, then why would the Iowa Utilities Board approve the permit? The Iowa Utilities Board was supposed to have hearings on this in October. Those were moved up to late August. And so I'm going to be curious to see whether the Utilities Board, this is a three-member body, all appointed by Governor Reynolds, and two of the appointees are new, and they only just started serving since May. So we'll see how they handle the situation.
And we should say very briefly that the opponents of the pipeline in Iowa run the gamut of the political spectrum.
Oh, absolutely. Everything from the Sierra Club and Iowa Citizens for Community Improvement, which are considered left of center, but many of very conservative politicians, former member of Congress Steve King has been very active in trying to oppose the pipeline, and dozens of Republican county supervisors have formally objected to the pipeline as well.
All right, a couple of minutes left. I spelled this one right on the format, Pottawatomie County. I'm going to repeat it. Pottawatomie County voters decided on supervisors' districts, and this was an interesting outcome. Let's background the whole thing.
Yes, so Pottawatomie County it includes Council Bluffs in western Iowa. There has not been a Democratic county supervisor there in 30 years. They elect all five county supervisors at large. That means everybody in the county votes. And even though during that whole time, at least part of Council Bluffs has elected a Democrat to either the Iowa House or the Iowa Senate or both, the Democrats have been unable to win any countywide elections for that supervisor's position. So groups of some organized labor groups and other progressive activists in the county had called for this referendum. They collected enough signatures to force a referendum on changing the system so that the supervisors would be elected by district. And then presumably Democrats would have a better chance of electing county supervisors from some of the areas of Council Bluffs. But it wasn't a very close election. It went down by about 64% voted to keep the status quo method of electing, and only about 29%. So that was more than 2-1 margin. Only about 29% voted to change to this district model. And I think it's interesting because some Republicans in the state legislature have advocated for forcing counties, including Story County, to switch to this district level where only people in, or supervisors have to live in a district, only people in a district elect the supervisor. And now we just saw Republicans in Pottawatomie County overwhelmingly oppose that kind of a change. So I'm going to be watching during next year's legislative session to see if there's any attempt to revive that bill that would have forced certain counties to move from at-large supervisor elections to district-level elections.
And 15 seconds, what are you going to be watching for this week?
Oh, the Iowa State Fair, absolutely. Who's there? What are they saying? And how's it all going?
Pork chop on a stick, voted the favorite food again. I'm going to tell you sometime about when I was walking down the Midway with two pork chops on a stick, one in each hand. And Laura, I actually ate both of them.
Oh, I just love Botter's ice cream. I'll just, if I get Botter's ice cream and lemonade from the honey producer stand in the Ag Building, it's been a successful Iowa State Fair for me.
That's it. Let's go out to dinner after this. We are out of time for this edition of Capital Week. A reminder that the views and opinions expressed here did not necessarily reflect the opinions of KHOI or its staff. Laura and I, my name's Dennis Hart, we'll be back here in the same time slot next week. And as usual, we'll talk about everything interesting or important or even entertaining that takes place in Iowa politics. And as always, we hope you can join us. Between now and then, we hope you have a safe, healthy, and very happy week. Go to the fair and have fun.